In the summer of 2003, I decided I wanted to set a novel in the infamous, notorious United States prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So I knew I'd have to get permission to the Pentagon, and at the time I was still working as a reporter for The Sun, so I went to my editor, and budgets were very small in those days, smaller still now, and I said, look, I've got a deal. I want to go down there and do some research, but if I pay the expenses, I'll write you a story, and I'll get my research done. How's that? And they loved the idea. They especially liked the part about I'll pay for it. So they said, go ahead. So I flew down there via Puerto Rico, and I landed at the U.S. Naval Base down there, which is across the bay from where all of the prison stuff is. And actually, where they put you up when you go down there to visit is this little place called Bachelor's Quarters. It looks like an old Days Inn, sort of, except drearier. So I stayed there, and in the morning, when it's time to go over for your interviews, you have ride this ferry boat across because they want to keep you separated from where everything's going on. In fact, when you're a reporter traveling at Guantanamo, it's kind of like being in a third world dictatorship because at all times, you're with a minder. And they not only keep track of you and make sure you don't wander off to someplace you're not supposed to, they make sure that people who are talking to you know that they're listening as well. So it's a bit of control going on. So they paired me up with another reporter, a fellow from the BBC, very experienced, Gordon Carrera. So there we were, heading on over. And one of the guys at the top of our list was the Muslim chaplain, because both of us, in doing our research, had seen that he was very candid and very frank, and we thought, this guy really opens up. And he was one of the few people they were going to let us talk to who had daily contact with the prisoners. Now, the lay of the land there at the time, there were 632 prisoners. And the vast majority of them, by then, even the interrogators and the FBI had concluded that the vast majority, they really don't know why they were there. They had picked up on the battlefield. They were turned in for bounties. They were pretty much worthless for intelligence. It wasn't even clear what they had done, if anything. There were a few dozen who were pretty hard cases. On the other hand, guarding them, they had 2,400 National Guard personnel and Army personnel who were down there as the prison employees. They would be down there for six-month hitches. And they'd had it drilled into them that these are the worst of the worst, and they are the absolute fearsome terrorists of the world. So there was a lot of that going on. So they had a completely different view. And these are a lot of, 19-year-olds from the Corn Belt and whatnot. So that's the atmosphere you've got going in. Now, if you're down on the beach at Guantanamo, and they had a lot of nice beaches, you'd think you were at a Caribbean resort. Beautiful aquamarine waters, palm trees, nice breezes. And, every now and then a three-foot iguana would run up to you wanting something to eat because all the soldiers feed them with crap from the vending machines. So they're out there wandering around. So anyway, the day that I was getting up for all these interviews, I heard somebody's boombox playing over in the barracks where all the soldiers live. And it was the Allman Brothers song, Revival, where the key lyric is, "People, can you feel it? Love is everywhere." Well, by then, it was pretty clear that love was not everywhere at Guantanamo. It was mostly a lot of suspicion between the inmates and the guards and a lot of fear, and it was a lot of tension down there. So finally, we get scheduled for our interview with the Muslim chaplain, and they set us up to interview him at a place called the Tiki Bar, which it was sort of the military's idea of Caribbean ambiance. It had a little thatch roof on the bar, and the drinks had umbrellas, and it was on a slab of concrete with a pretty nice view of the bay, which was kind of spoiled by the prison in between. And it was kind of an odd choice to be interviewing the Muslim chaplain because, being devout, he did not drink. So Gordon, the BBC reporter, and I had our beers and sat down at a picnic table, and James Yusef Yee, who was the Muslim chaplain, sat down and had his Coke. And we interviewed him, and it began, and we started with great hopes, and it was a complete dud. He was careful. He was guarded. His minder didn't once have to step forward and say, "I think you're being a little too candid there." We kept asking the same types of questions over and over to try to pry our way into what prisoners were thinking, what their lives were like, what he saw of it, and it went nowhere. And Gordon and I kind of said, well, that was too bad. So we finished the rest of our research, did our tours, got in the prison, got kicked out when there was a security alert, and I flew back to Baltimore, Gordon flew back to London, and 2 weeks later, I'm on the internet, and a newsflash comes up. Big story. It was the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo has been arrested and charged with espionage, sedition, spying, it was like 7 ultra serious charges for which you can get all kind of ultra serious punishments. And I got on and I emailed Gordon. I said, what the hell? And you got to realize, Gordon is a guy who's written a 1-volume history of MI6, which is the British CIA. I'm a guy who writes a lot of spy novels and intrigue. So he was an expert on spies and spying. I like to think of myself as at least an authority on fictional spies and spying. And we'd missed this. We said, shouldn't we have noticed something? You know, what's going on here? Well, as it turned out, what was going on was a lot of that suspicion we'd noticed, a lot of that sort of drilling into these young, impressionable soldiers who were very callow and inexperienced, that these were the worst of the worst. What they saw when they saw the Muslim chaplain was a man who spoke the language of many of the prisoners, spoke Arabic, who prayed with them, who was seen confiding with them, who represented some of their problems to the authorities. So little things had become big things, and big things had become enormous things. And after a while, he ended up being charged with all these horrendous charges. Well, as push came to shove, the weeks passed, the months passed, they ended up dropping all charges. I think all he ever ended up with was some sanction over adultery, which was very weird. He received an honorable discharge, and he is still seeking to this day an apology from the military. But one little twist that happened about a year after that, after my book came out, set at Guantanamo, he got wind of it. He saw it. I think he might have been mentioned in the acknowledgments among the people I talked to. And he then friended me on Facebook. So after all, if maybe love wasn't in the air, but maybe some little bit of friendship came out of that after all. So that's my tale. Thank you.